Fishing like a local isn't just about catching fish. It's about connecting with the environment and the people who call it home. It's about hearing the stories and traditions that have been passed down for generations and sharing unforgettable moments with the people you meet along the way. Fishing like a local is having an experience that stays with you forever. And with Fishing Booker, you can experience it too, no matter where you are. Discover your next adventure on Fishing Booker.
This upcoming concert season will be all about the boots, and Tecovas is your stop for the best in Western style. Tecovas has seasonal and limited edition offerings this spring and summer, including men's and women's boots, apparel, hats, bags, and more. All Tecovas boots are made by hand in a time-honored tradition with timeless styles that are always on trend. And Tecovas has first wear comfort with little to no break-in period. It's hard to find this level of comfort paired with this level of style. Stop by your local Tecovas store, have a complimentary drink or two, that's WCB style, and shop new styles. The smell of fresh leather and friendly staff are at your service. Many stores even have leather custom branding to make your boots truly personalized. And with regular live music and events, there's no in-store experience like it. If you can't make it into a store, just visit tecovas.com. That's T-E-C-O-V-A-S.com. They offer free shipping on all boots, as well as free returns and exchanges, and ship right to your door. Go to tecovas.com and find your new favorite pair of boots today.
When it comes down to it, what are we at our core? We are North American waterfowl. Hello and welcome to another edition of the North American Waterfowler Podcast. My name is Elliot, and today I am going to bring to you a guest from the Atlantic coast as we've been popping around North America and talking to different individuals about their season, the migration, and also just whatever questions I find interesting to ask. I hope that you enjoyed that last podcast with Matt Light, New England Patriot Hall of Famer, 11-time NFL veteran. I know that I enjoyed it. It was really fun for me just to be able to talk a little football with a professional football player, and also the Tom Brady of turkey hunting story, which if you have not watched that video, guys, it is on the Facebook group, the North American Waterfowler Facebook group over there on Facebook. So go and check that out. But today I am bringing on Captain Ruben Perez, who has been a long time sea duck hunter on the Atlantic coast, Atlantic Flyway. And so he is a guide, and he has been guiding sea ducks out there, I think he said, since the mid 80s. He's one of the original captains guiding for sea ducks in that area. So I've already recorded this episode. It was a great opportunity for me to educate myself. I mean, I know of sea duck hunting. I know some minor basics of sea duck hunting, but certainly it's not my thing. I've never even seen a sea duck. So this was a great opportunity for me to be educated and pick his brain and just talk all about sea duck hunting and the migration on the Atlantic coast and whatnot. So I hope that you enjoy this episode. We're going to jump right into that. But before we do that, don't forget the partners. Final Approach, FABrand.com, 10% off FDH10. Motion Ducks Decoy Spreader System. Get motion on those non-wind days. Kill more birds on those days, I promise you. Ever since I've been using it, I kill more birds on days where there's not much wind. And Onyx Hunt, the number one app for tagging your places and many, many, many more. There's a cool feature on there where you can set a location that you think the wind is ideal. And when you set it, you'll get a little indication of this is an ideal day based on the wind for this location that you pinned. Really, really cool stuff on X Hunt. So we're going to get into this here just a second. I'm going to be coming the next episode. I'm going to tell all about my snow goose hunt that I went on with Jeremy and Aiden and myself last weekend. I'm working on this video. I've been working on it today. I'm not sure when it'll come out, but man, what a waterfowl viewing experience this was. That is the main thing I love about snow goose hunting. Snow goose hunting for me, I'm not an avid snow goose hunter. I don't own socks. Aiden owns about 1,000. But what I love about February and March is maybe 2 or 3 times getting to go on snow goose hunts. And I don't view it as, like, when I go duck hunting, my goal is to shoot limits. If I don't shoot limits, it's not the end of the world, but that is always my goal. With snow goose hunting, I have a much different state of mind. Snow goose are such incredible birds, and the way that they flock together in thousands and thousands and thousands of them, and then the audio spectacle that they are, when you can get yourself up close to 30, 40, 50, 100,000 snow geese, it is, oh my gosh, it is just a miracle from God. And that's what happened on this hunt. I'm going to tell all about it on the next episode, but man, it was a viewing spectacle. And we saw a duck feed about a mile away like I have never seen before. Widgeon and Pintail just funneling down from the heavens. What a weekend it was. I'm going back out this weekend with Aiden and Matt Vacci. I'm so excited about that. So I'll talk more about that on the next episode. So be ready for that. But let's go ahead and jump into this with Captain Ruben Perez. Hello, today I am joined by Captain Ruben Perez, who is a longtime sea duck hunter on the East Coast, has a guide service. So today we're going to talk with him about sea duck hunting, and he's going to fill us in everything that you would need to know for sea duck hunting, because I don't know anything. I barely even know what species is shot. So let's go ahead and bring him on now. Captain, how are you doing tonight?
Great, Elliot. How are you?
I'm doing wonderful. Thank you so much for taking the time out of your schedule and coming on here and talking to all of us. Let's start off by you just give a little description of your guide service, where you're located, what you got into guiding, and a little bit of background of your whole business there.
Roger. So the name of my guide service is East Coast Guide Service. I am located in Massachusetts, and I hunt out of Cape Cod area. If people look at the map, they'll see that arm that sticks out, all that water there. I hunt it all, from Boston south to Rhode Island even. I go where the birds are. I mean, it's something that they're, you know, because they were there last year or they were there last week, it doesn't mean it's gonna, they're going to be there tomorrow. It's one of those things you need to keep up with it all constantly. And, you know, I've been doing it for a long time. I have a master's 100-ton license by the United States Coast Guard, which is what you need if you want to take people out for hire. And, yeah, it's a lot of guys have six packs. I decided to go a little further. it's just how I am. I'm anal, I guess. And, anyway, it's been a great thing. It was a natural progression. I love duck hunting. I've loved it since I was, 8 years old, when my dad used to take me out, and just one thing led to another. I mean, we weren't very good hunters at the time.
So how did you, cause you said that you originally started your duck hunting career with your father and you were kind of chasing puddle ducks. How did you turn into such an avid sea duck hunter? And at what point did you decide that you could possibly do this as a career?
We hunted the bays. I was originally from New Hampshire, and up there we have the Great Bay. And there weren't that many eiders at the time, but there were some scoters, and we started hitting the salt water through that. And then I used to be a journalist. I used to work for newspapers. I would take pictures, so I would work for the Boston Globe, Providence Journal, and whatnot. So I moved a lot around my career, and wherever I went, I was always looking for duck time. I mean, that was number one for me. And when I came to Rhode Island back in 1984, I believe, I already had been duck hunting, sea duck hunting for quite a while. And I started looking around, and sure enough, you know, there was a lot of birds in those days. It was just, unknown. People just didn't know. It was never publicized in magazines or in, you would never see a TV show about sea duck hunting. As a matter of fact, I think the first sea duck hunting TV shows you ever seen were put on by Mossy Oak when they used to have the Whistling Wings series. Fred Zink, who's a very good friend, he and I, we were talking about one time, and said, "Freddie, why don't you do a thing on sea duck hunting? I mean, it's just crazy." And he threw it past the boys over in Mossy Oak, and they said, "Yeah, let's do it." And he came up and hunted with me. I was guiding at the time, and little by little, step by step, it started to become popular. As far as how I did it, I mean, I let, if it's a duck and it's legal, I'll chase it and I'll hunt it, you know, and I'll figure out a way to cook it. Right. People say sea ducks don't taste very good. That's not true. You just need to cook them right. You know, you can ruin a yearling doe if you don't cook it right. Mm-hmm. So down here in Massachusetts, in Rhode Island, it wasn't a big thing. So there were very few, actually, there were no guides. There was only one guy that I knew about in Massachusetts, Pat Casey. And that was, man, that was ages ago. The only guides you would find would be up in Maine. That's where sea duck hunting was big. You know, people always correlate. Eiders in Maine. Maine Eiders. They even call them. You know, it's an anonymous name. Maine Eiders. Just like Arkansas is for greenheads, and California you go for the pintails, and in your neck of the woods, I'm not sure you guys go for everything. So,
Yeah, right.
Having been in the publishing business, I started writing for magazines, hunting magazines, such as Wildfowl, Waterfowl Hunter, Outdoor Life. I mean, several magazines. And I tried promoting the fact that there's great sea duck hunting up here. But, you know, the editors were a little leery because they always had that grid. You know, they wanted, if you're going to do a sea duck story, you got to do it from Maine. So here I am. I'm leaving, like, bonanza of sea duck hunting, and I'm going up to Maine to do a story up there, which is, it was bizarre, you know. And I just started guiding. It was a natural progression. It seemed like it's something that people enjoyed doing. And I started slow, and then it became known. Word of mouth is an amazing thing, you know. And people would call me up, "I want to go hunt some eiders and sea duck." And this is before the 41, you know, the Quest 41. Those two genes came up with that idea.
Right.
It was around. Now it's like everybody wants to have you know, one of every species in North America, because they need to hit all the buttons and all the.
Right.
Things there. But so, you know, I enjoy doing it. I provided a service for people because it's not an easy hunt that you can do on your own. You have to have the right amount of equipment, the big boats, the decoys, all that is extremely expensive just to do it once or twice in a season. So most people don't want to bother doing that. So they had to hire a guide. Mm-hmm. And then I threw little by little, I threw in layouts and whatnot. And that more stuff, more expense, and people just don't want to go through that. But now, you know, it's getting cheaper. People are buying the big tin boats and going out there, and you know, they want to do it themselves. But you know, the ocean is a scary place sometimes, you know.
So what is someone wanting to get into sea duck hunting, what is the bare minimum as far as equipment you would need to go on a sea duck hunt, all just as a regular?
Well, it's all
public land, freelance.
It's the ocean. Nobody owns it. So if you're a guide, some harbors, you have to pay extra money to launch your boats there because you're doing a commercial thing. But most people, if it's a state ramp, you can just put in your boat and go hunt. There are regulations how close to a house you can be and all that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's all written down in the laws. You know, people can just look it up. But the minimum that you need, I say you need a stout boat. You know, when I say stout, anything under 22 feet is not stout. You need 22 feet and up, you know.
Mm-hmm. What's ideal? What is yours? What's ideal size of
24,
boat?
25 mm-hmm. foot boat, something with high sides. I mean, sea duck hunting. I mean, what's the mm-hmm. first word? Sea. So you're in the Atlantic Ocean, where a lot of guys that come and do, you know, the freelancers, they don't realize that we have 12-foot tides in some places. Some places it's 5, some places 6, but there are some places you get 12-foot tides. And then you throw in some of these moon tides, you know, all of a sudden where there was water, there's no water, you know? So imagine running through there and you're looking at the charts, you know, you're thinking, oh, I got my GPS with charts on it. I'm okay. It says there's a rock right there. And all of a sudden you're looking at where the, oh, I'm not close to the rock. Boom. You just hit the rock and your lower unit is gone and all that. And let's say throw some waves into it. And then what do you do now? You know, you want to have some good sides to it so the water doesn't come in the boat. I don't know anybody, any boat that's not sinkable. I mean, remember the Titanic. Yeah.
Right. How wide is your boat? It's my boat 24 foot feet, long. Actually. How wide about? 26. And what's the width on it?
Good question. It's as big as you can legally put it on the road. So I would, I don't know, 96 inches maybe. What's the widest you can have to put on the road legally to travel? That's what it is.
Yeah. Okay, so you need at least a 22 foot longboat with high sides. I mean, what else? What other equipment would you have to have?
The aluminum boats because they're very light and they're flex, and they're also a lot colder in the winter, and you get pounded like crazy on big waves out there. I mean, I'm sure you know people go, oh, you know, my boat's this. You know, look, I've been on the water since I was in my teens. And when I say the water, I'm not talking about a pond, a lake, or whatever. I'm talking about the Atlantic Ocean. And there are days, on a sunny day, on a flat-ass calm day, you know, your 10-year-old can be a great guide, you know, no problem. But what do you do when you get a squall all of a sudden comes up that was never forecasted? Or let's say you come down here and you got a window of a week and all of a sudden they got these nor'easters and, real wicked winds and it's cold, you know, are you going to go out there? I have to go out every day. Every single day during the season, I'm out there. You know, except on Sundays. I try not to book on Sundays, but other than that, every single day, I'm there. So I can't pick the weather that's coming. Correct. So I.
So you have to be prepared for it. So what size motor? What size motor? Is minimum horsepower?
I mean, you need to understand that if you're running big decoys and you're doing long lines, you're using a lot of heavy weights. Then you throw into the fact that, you know, every guy brings in, you know, a kitchen sink in their bag. And I had a guy this season actually brought in a couple of those heaters, the Mr. Buddies. And I said, no. It has to be strong enough to obviously get more motor than you think you're going to need. That's always been there. Like mine is a 300 horsepower on a boat. It moves 30 miles an hour easily. When I got six guys, I'm talking about big Wisconsin guys, you know, and all their gear and all my gear and all the weight and all the water that's inside the decoys. I mean, my boat probably weighs about 5,000 pounds. And that, in a sense, the fiberglass and heavy boats give it stability. You know, there's boat builders out there that they claim, oh, yeah, mine's, you know, you can't put that against a rock. You can't run up on a rock. Well, I don't know anybody wants to run a boat into a rock, whether it's a woman or not, you know. It's like, we're indestructible. Yeah, okay. Yeah. The Titanic said that, too. You know, this is crazy stuff. I mean, you come out here, and when it's nasty, there's waves crashing on those rocks. I mean, do you want to put a client up there and make them climb up that slippery rock in the dark with gear? And then they don't think about the tide, and all of a sudden the tide comes up, and then you know, they're looking at their $12,000 worth of camera equipment floating away. You know, so minimum a good boat, a good stout boat. You need decoys, you know, four dozen or more.
So four dozen is kind of the minimum you would want to set up with.
Yeah.
Well, and what species are you using?
So if I'm going for eiders, I mainly put eiders. If I go for scoters, I mainly put scoters. The birds tend to want to be with their own kind. If I'm in an area, there's a mix, I'll put a little bit of everything, you know? So, but somebody just starting out, they're not going to have that ability to have that. And I mean, that's the advantage a guide has. We've been doing it for a while, and, you know, we're able to buy all this stuff. I mean, at least I do that. Every year I replenish all my equipment. You know, because I want to have the best gear that's possible to have. I don't want a client coming and saying, you know, hey, my decoys are better than yours. That's lousy stuff you got there. You know, you're asking people to pay money. You got to give them a good product. Right.
You change over all your decoys and everything every year?
I repaint them. Totally repaint them.
Oh, okay.
And I fix the ones that need to be fixed. You know, people, okay, so sea ducks, you're asking how it's about. Well, they come in low in the water. And they see your decoys from a distance away. And you, when you know they're coming, they're coming. That's where people think that they're dumb. They're not dumb. They just like to be with their own kind. They're very strong, species-oriented. They want to go to their own thing. So they're coming. They're coming. And once they come close enough, you know, you shoot them as they're decoying in. Well, guess what? I've had people say, oh, I just smacked the heck out of that duck. And I'm like, no, shoot him again. Shoot him again. Well, the duck goes in the water. Now it lands near my decoy, and these guys are shooting at the bird that's on the water trying to get it in my decoy. You know? Yeah. So what are you going to do? You know, so you just repair. That's what summer's for, repairing decoys and gear.
Yeah. On the decoys, so when you buy the decoys, and I assume that you buy them. I don't know how long you've been using and repainting them and everything. You buy them, but how does the anchoring system work? Like if I buy a dozen decoys, I'm just anchoring, you know, I'm putting an anchor on each and every one. How does the anchoring system work, and what do you have to buy special for that?
Yeah, that would take forever. We do long lines. And the long line system is been devised way before I ever started being, you know, duck hunting. So everybody tends to take from the last few guys and make it their own, you know. But the reality is, you put an anchor. You know, some people use bricks, some people use window weights. They use weights to you know to work out. So you need a lot of weight because you got currents. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you got tides. Remember the 12-foot tide and the 6-foot tide that I mentioned previously? Well, that water is going in out of these harbors and coming back out. So I mean, you got like rivers sometimes in some places, you know, where it funnels the water. So I mean, you need something to hold those decoys together. So you put an anchor to attach it to a line. The line's attached to your first decoys, and then you have a long line. It's, you know, it's a trot line, like going catfish hunting. Mm-hmm. You know, fishing, I should say. Each decoy has a short line attached to them, and they have a clip on the end. And you just clip them as you go along. Mm-hmm. I mean, that was the way that came about. That was from the long line industry of fishing for tuna and sailfish. Mm-hmm. I mean, out here we have, you know, Gloucester. I'm sure you've seen the movie Perfect Storm and all that. Mm-hmm. Well, if you watch that movie, you see these guys using those clips and attaching hooks to a long line that they put out. That line is like 3 miles long. Yeah. Oh, those are the same clips I use.
Okay.
What I do, instead of hooks, I put decoys on and on and on and on. And when I get to the end, you know, then I put another anchor on the other end.
Do the decoys come on and off after each hunt, or do they stay on the whole season and somehow you roll them up?
It really depends what species I'm hunting. Most of the time, they come on and off.
Every single hunt, you just, with your boat, you... Well, first of all, how deep is the water that you're typically hunting in?
Well, that's another reason why you don't want single lines, because it could be anywhere from 10 feet to 80 feet, you know? So how are you going to adjust that if you have single lines on each decoy? You can't have 80-foot line on that decoy and be sitting there and rolling it all day.
Yeah.
So what you – that main – the first thing you do is throw out that main anchor. Once you get to the point where it no longer is going out because it's hit bottom, now you start clipping decoys. And so that gives you that versatility to hunt different depth of water. Mm-hmm. You also have to take into account in your mind, when you go there, you know, it's funny. I'll go to a place and I'll just sit there and I'll look at the water for a while. My clients are looking at me like, what's wrong with this guy? And, I mean, we're in the dark and I'm looking around. I'm just trying to get the feel of which way the tide's going, and I'm trying to visualize what it's going to be 3 or 4 hours from now. It's going to change. That water goes in and out of these harbors every 6 hours.
Okay.
So imagine 12 hours going in and out of harbor every 6 hours. So at some point, you're going to have high tide. At some point, you're going to have low tide.
Yeah.
So you need to visualize. And, you know, I set out the decoys and do it that way. Long line is the only way you can really go.
I have so many questions that I don't even know where to go. This is... I have so many questions. This is also, like I said, I know nothing about this. So let's say you have an 80-foot, you're in 80-foot of water. How much line do you have on those long lines just on a day-to-day basis? Do you vary the length of line? Like, as you're scouting, like, well, today I think we're going to be in 20-foot of water, so let me do this preparation. Or is you just have one long line and it's how long, and that's just however deep you are, that's what you've got.
No, well, 80-foot of water is rare. There's a couple places that we hunt that. But I would say on the average, let's say it's 40, 50 feet. Uh-huh. Okay, so what you do is you just have extra lines with your hand to keep adding to it. You know what I mean? Okay, so you have workout weights, you uh-huh. know, like a dumbbell.
Right.
You attach it to the line. Now you throw that overboard, and that's going out of your hand. But in your depth finder, which is the most important thing you need, forget about the GPS and the chart and all that. That's not accurate. You know, I have seen so many people take out their lower units out here because they're following that like it's gospel. Mm-hmm. It's not. The depth finder is the key. Mm-hmm. You need to know how deep you are. So if you know if your line's of 30 feet and you got 60 feet under you, you know you're going to have to clip another line to it to make it 60 feet.
Okay.
So, flip another line to it, you throw it out. Once it gets to the end, now you attach another line to that same long line.
And you just
line.
Spool it right through your hands?
Yeah.
But how do you do that when it's got clips attached to it?
No, you don't attach. The clips are attached to the decoy line.
Okay. So, they literally just, the line, it just clips onto the line. There's no clip it clips on. It's just a straight line with an anchor on it.
Well, you can do it like that if you know different depth. What I like to do, since I do vary my depth, I have extra lines in a bucket that just have those the, like dog clips mm-hmm. from a dog leash on either end of them.
Right.
So the more, I just keep adding to that main first line that I threw overboard. And then when I get to the point that it's no longer pulling out of my hand, now I can start adding decoys.
Okay. So the line has no clips on it. What keeps the decoys from sliding up and down on the line, or can they freely slide up and down on the line, the decoys?
Well, those clips are strong.
And they clip tight to the line. Okay.
Right. So you got the decoy here. You got the keel. From here, you put a line about 36 inches long. The reason why we do it like that is if you use dogs, or sometimes you want to run your boat through the reg, mm-hmm. You don't have to worry about, you know, catching the long line that's way down here. Mm-hmm. So you put a dropper line here, and that dropper line is what has those clips
gotcha.
On it.
Gotcha. Okay. That makes sense. Then what goes on the end of the line? Is there something, you got an anchor on one side, is it some type of flotation device on the very far end of the decoys? Or the decoys is just what makes them float because they're decoys, and the line floats because the decoys.
The decoys float. The decoys float in the middle, and you have an anchor in the front and an anchor in the back. You can't let them loose because the tides will
mess them and they'll up. Move left to right. So you've got to anchor both ends. So you have a big, correct. Like, bow.
Correct.
Oh, okay. Correct. Okay.
That's a surf scoter, by the way. My father-in-law carved this years ago.
Oh, beautiful.
I mean, it's an amazing out of wood. He has the skills to do it. But that's one of the species that I hunt.
Right.
You know? Eiders and, you know, scoters, that's the basic thing. It's a hard concept of telling somebody about it, but just showing it, drawing it is a lot easier
yeah.
to do.
I've got it in my mind now. It's clicked in. I understand it. I was thinking the clips were attached to the line, but they're onto the decoys, and the decoys basically cinch onto the line. How many lines do you use then? Three different lines of decoys?
Different. I mean, depending where we are, what we're hunting, when. You know, it's just different. It's something that sometimes I use one, sometimes I use four, sometimes mm-hmm. I use six. I don't know. You know, it has a lot to do with location and how the birds want to work.
What would be a scenario that you would see that you would say, oh, we need more lines for this hunt versus oh, we need less lines? Just feel? Just, you know, and you just feel it because you've been doing it for so many years?
Yeah, I mean, pretty much. I mean, it's just, experience will tell you, you got to do something different. Mm-hmm. Move the boat, you know, maybe put more decoys out, maybe take out decoys, maybe put too many. These birds don't really, it's not like bluebills. You need huge rafts of 200 or 300 of them, mm-hmm. you know. What I use is big decoys, you know, so right. they see better.
Right.
I mean, you need to understand, out here, you always have swells. And then you add chalk to that. So it's always like 2 footers. You get a decoy that's small. Now you see it. Now you don't. Now you see it.
Right.
Get a big one. You know, it's going to stay in there. It's more important to have big decoys, big boats, and, safety gear. You need radios. I even go as far as having an EPIRB on my boat, which is a radio that you push the button. It's registered under my name. With the United States Coast Guard, they know whose EPIRB is going off, and they know that somebody's in peril. So hopefully they'll send the helicopter before we all turn blue floating in the water.
When you're setting out the lines, do they go from the boat directly out? I'm envisioning one in the middle, two on the sides. Do they just go straight out from the boat? And do you hunt out of – because I've seen, like, layout boat hunting. I've seen you talking about using skiffs. Do you hunt out of your main boat and shoot out of that?
Yeah, I hunt both ways. I hunt out of my main boat, and I'll hunt out of layout boats. So I don't like doing rock ledges for what I had mentioned before. You know, we get seaweeds on these rocks. To put a client out in the dark and make them climb a rock, it's like you're taking chances on somebody hurting themselves. And I've heard horror stories of people losing their guns as they're trying to transfer over and mm-hmm. going in the water. I haven't had it happen, but it's one of those things you don't need to do. If you have a good boat, my boat, the birds seem not to shy too much from it. They'll shy every boat after a while. I mean, they're not stupid. If they get pounded, you know, coming all the way down the Atlantic Flyway, after a while, they do start getting a little stale. Mm-hmm. But you need to change it up and do different things, you know? As far as how you put the decoys, you know what? The wind and the tide is going to basically tell you how to do it. You can't sit there and draw a form of how you, you know, I always chuckle when I see people doing drawings on how you should set up your decoys in accordance to where you're set up. Well, they obviously don't have tides.
Mm-hmm.
Because the tide, you know, if the tide's going this way and the wind's going that way, I mean, the decoys are going to be like all over the place. So it really comes down to a battle of, you know, where the tide is going to let you put those decoys. And you just try to stay near it.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24/7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Do you prefer a tide coming in versus out? Does that make a difference?
No, I prefer morning. I mean, the birds out here seem to die off around 10 o'clock.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they fly all day, but not like the numbers that you want, you know. To sit there in the hopes that you're going to get one more eider, you know, after, you know, 10, 11 o'clock, it's pretty difficult. See, we don't have boat traffic, and that tends to be the key, you know, to have birds always moving. Mm-hmm. We don't have that many hunters out here, at least the places that I hunt. I try to stay away from people. I don't really like having people too close around me because, it's an uncertainty, you know. I mean, I'm trying to provide a service to people that are paying good money. I don't want to deal with other people's, lack of knowledge to worry about, you know.
Right.
And
Do you use motion decoys of any kind, whether they be spinners or you don't need any of that for sea duck hunting?
I use flag. I tried it all. I tried spinners. I tried flag. No, I mean, it's being on the X is more important than anything else. So
how do state lines work in the ocean? If you were to cross from state to state, are there any state lines that matter once you get on the ocean, or you just open and go wherever you want?
It's fine on the maps and the charts that you're at. Mm. But it's funny because I asked the game warden one time, I said, what if I put in a ramp in Rhode Island because it's easier to get there by hunting mass? He goes, well, if I catch you on Rhode Island, I'm assuming you're hunting in Rhode Island.
Right. So if you come back with a bunch of birds and you're in Rhode Island, he's going to expect a Rhode Island tag, even though you may have not been hunting in there.
Yeah, exactly. So you better make sure that they're open for those species, because Massachusetts and Rhode Island don't open the season at the same time. Mm-hmm. They stagger them different ways, you know, the brant as well. I mean, so, yeah, you have to be careful. You have to know your laws. I mean, regulations is the main thing. Mm-hmm. You know, saying you didn't know, it's never going to work.
Yeah, you know, sorry, I didn't know. Okay, you're all right.
I'm sorry. You couldn't shoot a hollow. Yeah, you can't do that. Oh, what is this? A loon? Oh, boy. You know?
So other than, is it eider and scoter? Is that the bulk of what you harvest?
No. I eiders, all three scoters, the white wing, the surfs, and the commons, old squads. Old squads, you know, some people know them as long tail. Mm-hmm. But so brant, black ducks, and... You know, I hate to admit it, but some of my clients like shooting buffalo heads, and I let them do it. Right. You know, but buffalo heads, you got to think about buffies. You know,
yeah.
It's like you're admitting you didn't have a good day, so you're shooting something, right?
Right. Yep.
And we have other puddle ducks, but I mean, this is not where people come for puddle ducks. You know, they come here. They're looking mainly for the sea ducks, where they can't get anywhere else.
So, what is desirable? List me the in order kind of importance. Of what you would like here, you know, you've got people really prize the pintails, canvasbacks, then mallards. We never see black ducks here. That's kind of would kind of be the order of importance of like people would be really excited to shoot. How does the sea ducks lay out?
Eiders, number one.
Are there different types of eiders?
They are. Once in a while, we get a king eider out here,
but that's rare.
Uh-huh. You know, if somebody says to me, I want to shoot a king eider, I say, don't come here. Mm. Go to Iceland or go to Alaska.
Okay.
But I have had 17 shot in my boat. I don't know anybody's had that many eiders shot in their boat.
Nice.
But I have had clients, 17 of them have shot king eiders in my boat, some really nice ones. I mean, that's if you see my logo, it has all the species. You got the white wing, the surf. The white wing scoter, surf scoter, common scoter, the old squaw, the eider, and the king. That's because I had a group of clients from Wisconsin, I believe, about 5-6 years ago. They came down in 2 hours of hunting. We had all those birds decoy in, and they shot them. That's what you call a royal slam.
Okay.
You know what I mean? A northeast slam would be the one without the king eider. But a royal slam, you know, they all drakes, obviously. You know, it can't be hen. It has to be, you know. It has to look like a king eider that people expect to see. It looks like that.
Yeah.
That one that I got.
Right.
And we did it by, we were sitting in my big boat, anchored, and they all decoyed right in. We didn't all of a sudden say, hey, you know, we're close to a royal slam. Let's unanchor and go run down. There's a king eider that I know about up the street because the clamor told me. You know, I actually heard that happen up in Boston, you know, so it's like, yeah, I wasn't there, so I can't say, you know, but I mean, you know how it is. Sometimes some stories have legs to them. Absolutely. You know? So, the main thing. And then you get the black ducks and the brant. I mean, out here, we're very fortunate that we get so many different species that it's a place that a lot of people want to come and basically get all those checked off their list.
Yeah.
You know, I've had clients come out here like with a list about this long. And look, you know, it's almost like I feel like I'm at a restaurant. You know, they want a, you know, a side of old squaws, the main course, you want the eider,
yeah.
You know, tide to bring me a scoter, to, you know.
At 9:30, I would like to shoot a king eider. At 9:45,
yeah. That's my life right there. Yeah.
How does the migration work for sea ducks? Where do they nest? Where do they hatch? And what is it, all weather based? And how does the migration work with them?
Excuse me. They're mostly from Canada. Mm-hmm. I mean, these birds, we have local eiders, nesting eiders here, but the main bulk of the birds that I shoot tend to be Canadian birds. They're nicely plumed out. They got those beautiful colors that you see that you want, you know, the whites and the blacks and the beautiful lobes on their faces. I know this through a lot of banded birds that we shot on my boat. Most of them seem to be Canadian birds. Mm-hmm. But Maine, Mass, and Rhode Island has some nesting eiders, but I wouldn't say it's something that, you know, you want to write home to your mother about. So mostly Canadian birds. And same thing with scoters. They're all up in Canada, and then they all of a sudden, I don't know if it has to be weather. Something has to trigger them to start coming down. But back in the day, about 6 years ago, we used to be able to hunt 106 days. Now it's only 60, and they have to follow the duck season. But in those days, we could hunt in October, first week of October, and we're covered up here. Go to the in October. And the eiders, you have to wait a little bit if you want them nicely plumed out, you know, and you have to wait until about the first week of November. Now it's not an issue anymore. You only have December and January that you have to get it done. So all these birds are plumed out. They're all in nice condition. Unless some local ones, you know, come in and they tend to look a little dirty. But I'm assuming that's what it is. And they start coming down. And, man, I'll tell you, Maine has lost a lot of their eiders in the last 10 years. The eiders, for whatever reason, have decided to come down here to Mass and winter up in here. My assumption is that up there they had a very, very strong commercial community of shell fishermen. And, you know, you take their food source away, you know, what are the birds going to do? They're going to go find new sources. Mm-hmm. So I think that's what's happened. But mostly they come down here and they winter up in Mass and Rhode Island. You'll get a handful maybe that will fly down to New York and New Jersey, but I mean, this guy's saying, "Oh yeah, we shoot eiders." Yeah, okay. You're shooting some that maybe it got lost and you know, hit a storm or something. But this is where you want to be. Now the scoters are different. They'll continue further south. Mm-hmm. You know, they'll go to Maryland and Carolinas. The old squads. Now the old squads are in the Great Lakes. You know, so they're kind of expanding around.
where do they, what's their nesting habitat? Where do they actually have their nests and hatch?
They're in islands. They're in barren islands, and you okay. know, they go up there and, you know, they try to make a little nest somewhere hidden in rocks, and they're very susceptible to predators. You know, the foxes and the mostly seagulls. Mm-hmm. They tend to predate a lot on their eggs. So it's a problem.
Offshore on just little outcroppings of rocks and things like that.
Correct.
Okay. That's really interesting. Yep. What are the population status of sea ducks right now? Are they up? Are they down? What's the long-term outlook?
Nobody knows. The United States Fish and Wildlife hasn't done a serious study in years. So
that's
they
odd.
Have no idea.
That's odd.
I think, well, it is odd. I think most of the I'm going to get people really angry at me for saying this, but I think most of their temperature taken of what the status is going on the birds is what they see on online, on Facebook, on Instagram.
Really?
You know, they see with piles of birds like myself and other people, and they think, oh my God, they're killing all our birds, you know. And I mean, that happened a few years back, and you know, when they sent out a plane and they couldn't find them, and they found out that they were down here in Massachusetts. So they're not in the traditional location. Mm-hmm. So it's got to be a problem. No, the birds are just shifting and moving, just like the mallards now. I mean, what do you hear from Arkansas? I mean, is that still the capital of the greenhead?
A lot of complaining is what you hear from Arkansas. A lot of complaining. They're all coming up to Kansas to hunt is what they're doing.
Well.
How do they set season dates if they have no idea the health of the population? They just do it. Because you said it used to be over 100 days and they cut it to 60 with no data at all?
Well, I mean, I guess they claim they had data. I've the stuff that I read. I mean, remember this? I used to write about these things. Yeah. You know, you ever see the forecast that you see about, you know, the breeding pairs and the ponds and this and that? I was the journalist. They used to do that for some magazine. Mm-hmm. You know, so I don't know. I mean, I hate to. I got my theories, but it's just theories. Unless I can, you know, have solid proof that you know what my theories are, I don't want to really put it out there for right. General. Well, I mean, you guys can read the lines, you know.
Right.
I mean, as far as the last study that they've done on eiders was 1995.
Wow. So, from what are you started hunting sea ducks kind of mid 80s? How do you feel about the populations? Do you feel like there's more now than there was, or less? Are you concerned? What are trends just as far as you're experiencing? You're out there every day of the season.
I think guiders like turkey have gotten smart, and they tend to shy off a lot of boats. So they have gotten pounded hard, so they've developed that instinct to just to stay away from people.
Mm-hmm.
The layouts. They're susceptible to layups. That's why a lot of these guides are using layups specifically, including myself. Sometimes depending on where I am, I want to have my clients have different experiences.
Right.
I'm not at the same place twice. I usually, you know, we hunt here today. We're going to go someplace tomorrow and then someplace else. But these guys just pound the heck out of the birds in the same spot over and over and over again, you know? So they get smart. I mean, if you were getting shot at every day, every time you crossed, you know, went by a neighbor's house, would you go near that neighbor's house anymore? Right. Yeah, so that's what's happening. So they get smart, and so they moved. They moved to areas that they're harder to reach. I mean, I know places that there are thousands. I mean, they look like bees. I got videos of it, you know, and they just out there in the open water. They just don't come in anywhere close that you know, you're safe setting up for a hunt when it's bad weather. You know, you can only reach them on certain special days.
So you feel like the population's healthy?
I wouldn't say healthy is, I haven't seen that much of a change.
Okay.
Other than the fact that they're not in the traditional places we usually hunt them. Like, let's say I used to hunt Harbor A.
Mm-hmm.
I used to 10,000 eiders there. Well, that Harbor A right now doesn't have any more eiders. Well, guess what? They were doing commercial clamming there. So, and you have draggers out there taking their food. So they moved to another place. So if I only knew and only saw that one spot, I would say, oh my God, the birds are gone. Mm-hmm. Since I hunt and move around a lot and scout, I mean, every day after I finish hunting, my clients will go have lunch. I'll get in my truck and I'll start scouting.
Yeah,
I don't get home till dark, you know. And they can't wait to go post on Facebook, you know, to look what I did, you know. I'm like, you know, no, I want to. I worry about how my clients are going to do tomorrow. Forget about how I did yesterday. Yeah. So I'm not looking at, and you find them if you search around a lot, you do find them. You know, like I said, remember I don't hunt the same place two days in a row.
So you scout by truck with binoculars? I've never been to the East Coast, but I'm imagining all of the shoreline is just houses, businesses. So how do you go about scouting them? You just drive roads that are as close to the ocean as possible and glass?
Well, when I can, I glass, but a lot of times you just go to a ramp and just put the boat in and take a ride.
Okay.
Most, I would say 80% of the time I have to take a ride.
Mm-hmm. Why do they congregate in certain areas? Is it because of food source? And what is, it seems like you implied that they eat mussels.
Yeah, that's what they do. They eat mussels.
Is that their number one food source?
Yep. I mean, they'll eat lobsters. They'll eat other, you know, they'll eat other things. They'll prey on other things. But the number one thing that they want is mussels.
How do they crack? How do they get through the shell?
What they do is they swallow it whole.
Really?
Yeah. The mussel has to be something about the size of your thumbnail.
Uh-huh.
They swallow that whole, and they'll swallow a bunch of them. Uh-huh. And then, you know, in their gizzards or whatever, they get crushed in there. And, you know, the meat and whatever, it gets digested. And if you see, if you ever seen an eider poop, it's little pellets of mussels. You know, it's crazy.
The shell, they're like crapping out the shells.
Well, they poop out the shells. Yeah.
So they've got the grit in their crop that just grinds. So they're eating small mussels. Small.
Correct.
Okay. Real small ones. The grit in the crop, which they probably pick up off the bottom at times during the day. Little rocks and what have you, and it just crushes it in there, and that's fascinating. I had no idea.
No, they're amazing birds, but see, that's the other issue that comes up. Those mussels don't stay the same size. They take it bigger and bigger and bigger, and now the eiders can't swallow.
Mm-hmm.
So when people say, oh, I know where he hunted last year, this is where to go, maybe, but those mussels have grown, so those birds have shifted and went someplace else.
How far down can they go? How far down can they dive to get their food?
Well, the eiders tend to go from 0 to, 30, 40 feet.
Wow.
The scot is like deeper water, 30, 45. And the old squads probably will feed on to 90 feet or so.
Oh, my gosh. Imagine the amount of energy it takes for them to go 90 feet to the bottom. How do they even visually see what... At 90 feet, wouldn't the sunlight be pretty dim? Or is it still...
I would say in the winter, the water's a little less cloudy, but I would think, yeah. They're amazing birds. I mean, if you want to hunt old squaws, you got to go to the deep water. That's a known thing because they like deeper water. But the eiders, they can be in shallower areas. No, they are amazing birds, and I think that's one of the reasons why they fascinate me so much and why I target them.
Yeah.
It's a love relationship that I have. I don't hunt when I got clients on the boat. I haven't brought a gun on the boat for years. Mm-hmm. So I don't kill myself. I don't need to.
Yeah.
I let people enjoy the hunt, and the guys that I have, a lot of them, targeting the birds that they want, and some will stalk once they got that bird. They don't have to pound the heck out of the limits,
Yeah.
And that's
they're trophy hunting more than any, or species hunting or trophy hunting more than anything.
Correct.
Yeah.
I mean, I think what has pushed that a lot has been that, chase for the 41 North American,
Yeah.
I had Mark, just blanked out on his name. Oh, Mark's going to kill me. But he did all the 41s in one season.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah. And it was during COVID. It was that year of COVID, too.
That's disposable income right there.
Well, I guess he worked. But he hired me to – he had hunted with me many years ago. And he told the guy that was arranging the hunt for him to – make sure you get Reuben because he's a killer. Is that a good thing or a bad thing?
Oh, that, as far as I can tell, that's the number one compliment a waterfowler can give another waterfowler is to call them a killer. That's compliment number one, as far as I can tell.
Okay, so I'll take it as good.
Yeah.
He came with a long list, but he started with a long list. By the time he got to me, he only needed 2 or 3 birds when he was here, and no problem. I got him his brand in 5 minutes, and then we went to get the bluebill the next day. And then he had an issue that obviously Alaska was closed for the king eider.
Mm-hmm.
So it looked like he wasn't going to do his quest after all the effort and money he spent. So I tried to get him a king eider down here. I had heard, I knew an area that one hangs out a lot. So we went on the third day to look for it, but the thing was not there, even though I had a friend photographed it the day before. I was hoping to get Mark his king here. But he had to go to Iceland to do it. So.
Wow. I bet that sounds like a fun season of waterfowling. Yeah, I'm just going to run over to Iceland to get myself the king eider. That's a blessed life. These birds you're talking about sound so magnificent. And I know we had talked about this a little bit off air before as far as the tie-in to spirituality. And a lot of duck hunters, not all duck hunters, but I find a lot of duck hunters find so much closeness to God just watching the magnificence of wildlife. In fact, this is a known truth that the more you live in a big city, the less spiritual you are, and the more you're connected to nature, the more belief in God that you have. And I just find it, for most people, it's very, very difficult to sit out in wildlife day after day after day and just see something like a bird be able to dive 90 feet down in murky water and find food. Just things like that you start to piece together, and I look at them and I draw one conclusion. These are complex organisms. I mean, the amount of chemistry it takes from a bird to go from the gestation, through the egg, through everything, all of the encoded DNA in their body, I personally cannot look at that and think the most reasonable solution to me is there is a God. And I know that you are a spiritual man. Talk a little bit about connections you see through your duck hunting and your belief in Jesus and God.
Yeah, no, I'm in total agreement with you. I mean, how can somebody look at all that? How can somebody look at a beautiful sunrise or all the elements that come together and say, hey, that just happened.
Yeah.
That was chance.
Right.
You know, and you know, you're so right. I don't push politics. I don't push religion in my boat. But I do. I will ask the clients, hey, are you guys, you know, God-fearing? And if they say no, I let it go. Mm-hmm. If they say yeah, I've been asking, you know, what religion do you follow? And then it's amazing how I would say 90% of my hunters are religious, mm-hmm. and most of them are Christians.
Right.
Which makes it easy. I'm a Christian. You start talking at a different level at that point. The hunt becomes different.
Yeah.
It's amazing. I've had three really amazing hunts this year that happened. And it's not about, you know, being a holy roller or a Bible thumper. It's just basically talking about, hey, can you believe that people actually think this just happened?
Yeah.
Can you believe that people think that, you know, that it was it all from an amoeba and it got legs and it went? No, it's impossible.
Yeah.
It's impossible. It was created by a God that, you know, had a plan, is all powerful, all knowing. And then, and then I can get into more basics with, you know, being a Christian and why, you know, that works, you know. But I I had mentioned to you briefly before, by the way, Mark Patterson was the guy who shot the 41 bird.
Gotcha.
It was bugging me. Sorry, Mark. Sorry. But, you know, I'll tell you how duck hunting, it has become very obvious since I started to turn, you know, to Jesus and trying to live a better life, you know, being a better person, trying to be a little bit more, you know, respectful and more patient. And I mean, what I do for work is stressful. You deal with other, you know, competitors, you know, whether they're guides or freelancers and or whoever, or even the public that doesn't want you hunting, you know, they come out here and call you murderers or whatever. You probably don't have that in your neck of the woods, but I've had it happen here. I'm in the East Coast.
Right.
So it's just like, you know, liberal haven here.
Yeah.
And so I've tried, as I've gotten older, to, you know, be more, you know, spiritual. And anyhow, I had a friend, I knew of this man. He was like, one, you know how there's some duck hunters that are really, really good? You know, like the 2% that, you know, those are the killers, mm-hmm. you know. And, well, this guy was one of those guys. And he called me up. He never was a client of mine. He used to live in the area here. And I've always admired his decoys that he had. He has a local carver, two beautiful wooden decoys. He called me up and he said, hey, I live in Florida, but I'm going to be seeing my daughter. Can I come down and say hello, have a coffee? And sure, you know, it'd be nice. And he came up, and I'll tell you, I never invite anybody to my home. You know, it's kind of, it's my place. I don't want
to worry about
it. I was going to meet him at my sanctuary, correct. And something about it, I said to him, you know, Mike, why don't you come over to my house? You know, and he came. We had a good time. Talked for 2 hours. I like cigars. I, you know, smoke a cigar. Talk about duck hunting. And anyway, all that stuff. So it came to the time, you know, I was going to head out. A nice visit. And we get to his truck, and he says to me, all of a sudden, it's just so really weird. He says to me, hey, can I come and hunt with you next year? One time. I want to use my decoys. I want to hunt over for the last time. And I'm like, what do you mean for the last time? You know, what's the matter? Where are you going? What are you going to do? What? You're going to be done? Yeah.
Oh,
yeah,
man.
He has two severe health issues.
Mm.
And I was like, oh my God. So I said to him, hey, you know, are you, you believe in God? You know, and he goes, yeah. Do you believe in Jesus Christ? And he goes, yeah. And I said, you want to accept him in your heart as your Lord and Savior? He goes, yes. I said, say it. I want to hear you say it. And he said it. And I said, he just got saved, you know?
Right.
You know, now you just go and try to walk that walk. I'm not saying you're going to be miraculously, you know, have a, you know, have all this go away. But what you're going to have now is I'm going to pray for you, and you're going to pray for yourself, and you're going to ask to be restored. And it was funny because I said to him at that point, I said, can I say a prayer for you now? And he goes, yeah. I couldn't get through it, man. I was bawling like a baby. I oh my God, I couldn't get through it. I was like, oh Lord, you know, I'm so bad at this. You know, it was so emotional for me. And we're both hugging. I understand this. I just met the man 2 hours ago, you know.
Mm.
These two old guys are hugging each other, and I'm like, you know, I'm asking for restoration in his life and all that. And I told him straight out, I said, it doesn't mean you're going to have a miracle, but at least you're not alone.
Absolutely.
At your darkest moment.
Yeah.
So I turned around, and I apologized to him for not being able to keep it together. I looked around, I got woods around my house, and boom, it hit me. It hit me like that. I said, you know, Mike, you weren't here to talk about ducks, were you? He goes, no. I said, you were here to get saved. Two weeks later, he went over to my church. He was visiting, remember?
Right.
We had a baptism. He went over and got baptized. I'm assuming that everything, you know, I mean, he's got health issues, you know?
Yeah.
He went back to Florida. And so I don't know what's going on with my phone here. There we go. My phone just gave me things saying low storage. But he started coming to my church while he was here. It was amazing. He made all these spiritual friends, you know, and everything was, yeah, was doing great.
That is fantastic. So, fantastic story. And, you know, people who are reluctant maybe to make that decision feel like, well, I've got to give up this, I've got to give up that. And the truth is that when you make that decision, everything else takes care of. It takes care of itself because your desires change. Your desires change.
Right.
It's not difficult. I spent half of my life doing whatever I wanted to do. And then after a horrible divorce, I was like, all right, this is it. I can't do this by myself. I suck at making decisions. I can't do this. So I'm like, okay, God, I am yours. Make the decisions, lead me. Everything else just fell into place. I mean, giving up the getting drunk all the time and you know, those types of things, that was not an issue. It just, I became a different person, and it wasn't right. Like I had to, my desires and my wants changed. And so now I've got two parts of my life. I've got kind of half of, about up to about 35, where I would say I believed in God most of the time, but I was, you know, kind of did, kind of didn't, depending on the day. And then I've got half of my life where I was just like, okay, I'm taking this for serious, for real. And I can compare the two parts of my life, and I know how I felt, my decisions, my peace, everything in those two splits are completely different. And that's all the information I need. If it's not true, which I believe it is, if it's not, I'm still a better person and living a better life because of it. But I believe that it is true, and I've cast those doubt demons aside 95%. But even let's say it's not true, I am so much better person and happier following these principles than I was before.
No, it's totally. I mean, I agree with you. It's just, I mean, with me, like you, I was always a spiritual person, but my biggest problem was trusting a leader. You know, I was I used to be Catholic. You know, I enjoy the Catholic faith, but you know, all religions have issues, you know, and I needed to find someplace. And you know, I'm going to give a little shout out to Pastor Derek and Pastor Ken. We're very fortunate at the church that I go. We got these two men that just they speak the truth, and they tell you, go to the scriptures. You don't have to listen to my interpretation. Mm. Go to the scriptures, and they're amazing. They're good shepherds, and I think that's what I needed. I needed somebody I could trust. I'm not, you know, having been a former journalist And there's not many people I trust. It's almost like a police officer. We get to see the worst in people. Right. So you tend to not believe a lot, you know?
Yeah.
And that was helpful. I mean, so much so that I went from zero, you know, I stopped going to church to now I go, you know, when you asked me to do this recording, he said Monday, I said, I can't, I go to church.
Right.
Bible. So I go to church Sunday, I go to Bible study on Monday, on Wednesday night, I go to the night service. And it just continues like that. And I do other things in between because I love doing it. I just, I enjoy it and it's the way to go, you know? But
absolutely.
Yeah. I mean, I encourage anybody who's out there, if they have doubts and anxiety in their life, that they really should seek out God, because everything that's good comes from Him. Jesus is there. He gave His life for us because He loved us. I mean, He rose to show us that, you know, our sins were forgiven, and you know, there is a place to go after we leave this earth.
I couldn't agree more. And any of you that are listening, if any of this conversation is touching you and you have questions or you want to talk, feel free to reach out to me on any of my platforms, freelanceduckhunting@gmail.com, freelanceduckhunting on Instagram, or through Facebook, Elliot Snyder. Don't hesitate if you're like, you know, I have more questions, I want to talk about it. I would be more than happy to have a conversation with any of you that have more thoughts or questions about the spiritual side of these sayings. So I think that's a pretty good place to wrap it up. I do have probably 30 more questions, but we could go on for hours and hours. But you've really done a great job of educating me to that. I know now I have to go on a sea duck hunt at some point. I have to.
If anything, just the whole process, mm-hmm. It's amazing, you know?
Right. Well, go ahead and tell us one more time. What is the name of your guide service? If anyone did want to come and hunt with you, how could they reach you?
Yeah, it's East Coast Guide Service. They can Google that, or they can Google Captain Ruben Perez, or they can go to seaduckhunt.com. And I also have Hotmail and Gmail at seaduckhunt. And that's how they can do it. I'm on Facebook. I'm on Instagram. I mean, you can see pictures, hundreds and hundreds of pictures of clients that I've had in the past. And you can get a good idea of what my hunts are like. I mean, I like to think that they're pretty good, you know. But they can reach me that way. There's many ways.
Fantastic.
But, hey, thank you for the opportunity, my friend.
Yeah.
You know,
I appreciate you coming on here. And it's great to talk to a fellow brother who sees eye to eye with. And thank you for informing me and all my listeners on the ins and out of sea duck hunting. Well, I think we're going to wrap that up right there. Until next time, you have listened to another episode of the North American Waterfowler Podcast.